Greetings. Greetings to Mr. and Mrs. Middle America and all the ships at sea. This is Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett, and to the hostile alien armies hovering silently just outside of Earth's atmosphere behind their cloaking devices. Remember, eat the Canadians first, although they be frozen dinners perhaps tonight, because yeah, it's cold. It's cold everywhere, and getting worse for the East Coast. Adjust your travel plans accordingly. Oh, and if you're going to microwave the Canadians, just this little, serving tip: paper towel. Just wrap them in a paper towel. Keeps the moisture in. So, listen, this is the show that some people have been asking for a while. A couple of big stories we're going to be delving into. I'm going to dispense with some of the formalities we do at the beginning of a first hour guest like this, in terms of presenting some of the material that's on the website. There's some great stories, very interesting photographs, some interesting follow-ups from last night's show too, when we had on Diamond Dallas Page, the author of Positively Unstoppable: The Art of Owning It. He talked about his life as a professional wrestler, but also his discovery of his own version of yoga and how that's been used to turn around the lives of both people like himself, who had become so physically hampered from years of wrestling, but also being used to turn around the lives of people spiritually who had, incurred addictions, including food addictions. It was a very entertaining conversation. If you missed it, go back and catch it from last night. If you're a Coast insider, it's pretty easy to do. Just go to the website and sign up there if you're not. But tonight's show will involve two subjects, both of which in and of themselves are fascinating. But one, the first one we'll get to, is the one that people have been asking me about the most since I first was able to come back and start doing Coast to Coast again earlier in 2018. And that's an update on the smiley face killers. I wish there were no update. I mean, in the sense that I wish there was no further evidence of crimes. These tragedies have been going on for a while. I wish that the update we could give you is that people have been caught and they've been taken to court, and that we have some justice for the families who have suffered the loss of these young men across the country. But what we do have is nonetheless a fascinating update that appeared yesterday in the Daily Beast, and we'll talk with the author next. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Nicole Wisenseed Egan is a writer for the Daily Beast. At one time, she was writing also for People magazine. That's the first time I encountered her work. She joins us here on Coast to Coast AM. And I wanted to get to you right away. Nikki, I hear Nikki is okay?
Yep.
Okay. I want to get to you right away because, first of all, we share a little history on this story of the smiley face killers, because I was in the Twin Cities back in 2006, 7, and 8 when this story was kind of getting traction originally. And I worked with Christy Peel, who was the reporter for Channel 5 at Hubbard Broadcasting. We were in the same building. And she was the one who kind of got the story a little bit more blown open nationwide. But I also had a chance to go back and retrace the steps of some of the people, even one of them whom you mentioned in your article, and talk to some of the families that were involved in the disappearances of these young men in what has become known as the Smiley Face Killer case. Tell me how you first came upon it, when you first started to write about it over a decade ago.
Sure. It was right before Kevin Gann and Anthony Duarte were having their press conference in New York City. That it was like Monday, April 28th, I think it was. And Christy had just run her story, so she like broke the story. And then they were following up with this national press conference because, they wanted to get some national attention to it. They've been investigating this all on their own and low on funds, low on everything, traveling all across the country, and they wanted to get some publicity. And I still remember when my editor assigned me to it, I was sort of like, oh, come on, really?
Right.
But then the more we started looking into it, then we found out the Minneapolis police chief, wasn't discrediting it, that In fact, one of these cases had been turned into a homicide, and I went to that press conference that Monday, and then I took Kevin and all of them out to dinner that night on People to get to know them better that night as sources, because I figured this is not going away. You know, there's something like this. This is just the tip of the iceberg, and I just kind of stayed interested in it ever since, and it's been 11 years because.
For those people who hear us talk about it, or they've heard about the podcast, or they've heard about the limited series on television or whatever, sum up the story in its most credible version as you've interfaced with it over the years.
I mean, what they say is that there is, you know, and they use the term serial killers. What they say is there's a gang of organized killers that have these semi-autonomous cells in cities across the country, and that they target specific types of people to kill as part of either a gang initiation, a ritual, or as part of
thrill killing.
These are the guys, like a lot of them for a long while were these college-aged white men, 3.8 GPAs, athletes, tall, good-looking, strong, like the epiphany of like the perfect guy, and the people that they aren't, I guess. But more recently, like with the Dakota James case, they've been targeting gay males. From what I understand, there's been some women thrown into the mix in the last few years. That's what they say. And they say they operate, they communicate on the dark web. And at one point, they were actually given the URL for their site on the dark web, and they went to it, and then a video camera, like, turned on them when they were supposed to put in a password, and they just, of course, they didn't have the password. Someone had sent them the URL, and they kind of stopped. But, you know, I think I know very little of what they know. I think there's a lot they know that they haven't said. The smiley face aspect, though, is that the smiley face is at these scenes, but it's not just the smiley face. It's these 12 other symbols that are specific to this gang. And one of the people on their team is a nationally renowned gang expert who's a college professor. So there's like three retired New York City detectives investigating this, and a criminal justice professor in Minnesota who's a nationally renowned gang expert. So these aren't just, you know, citizen Joe out there trying to investigate it on their own. These are some people with some really strong credentials.
When the story first started breaking, there was a lot of pushback from mainstream law enforcement sources saying the public is making too much out of coincidental occurrences of these popular, good-looking, generally regarded as high-performing college-age students who were victims of a drunken accident, that they were the reason why they were found around rivers is because in these college towns they left bars, they went down to an area where they were going to urinate or skinny dip or whatever, and they fell into the river, and because they were so drunk they drowned. And this was this was the story that they had even told about several cases in the Twin Cities area when I was there. And I went back and retraced the steps of these students and tried to figure out whether there was anything to that, including one case from a St. Thomas student, St. Thomas University in St. Paul, who the police claimed had fallen off a rather large embankment and rolled down into the Mississippi. It was absolutely impossible to do that because there were just nothing but trees and stumps all the way down. It would have been like the most improbable case of pachinko for this, you know, guy to have fallen all the way down in between all of these trees and ended up in the river. And yet they stuck to that story until, as you pointed out, the Minneapolis police chief recanted. They regretfully said that they had not done their proper due diligence and even apologized to the family of one of the victims and said clearly he was a victim of a homicide. But these were not admissions fast in coming. And as you point out in your article in the Daily Beast, most still in the overwhelming number of cases, the police are unwilling to say that these victims, though they all share a similar profile, are the victims of a homicide.
Well, I know. It's exactly. I mean, no one wants to own this. And when you look at it collectively, you can say, okay, maybe it was, you know, all these guys getting drunk. But when you start looking at each of these cases individually and do what you did and start going to the scenes and see what these detectives did, you can see how they all start to fall apart. And that's what, you know, the FBI did a review of it in 2008, and all they did was look at the reports. And from what I understand, they didn't even have all of the documents on each of the cases and decided to concur with the police. But they never did any of their own investigating. They never talked to the detectives. They never, you know, did anything that these guys have done. They've traveled all over the country and gone to all these scenes. And then the Center for Homicide Research debunked this. That's what everybody's saying right now. Oh, this was debunked in 2010 by the Center for Homicide Research. Well, I went and actually read that report, which I'm sure very few journalists have done.
Right.
And all they did was read a bunch of news clippings and come to a conclusion. And the guy who concluded this is not even a veteran investigator himself. He was a firefighter for 22 years. Yet he hasn't gone to any of these scenes. I'm sure he did this analysis sitting at his desk in Minnesota, and he didn't actually go to any of these scenes himself or look at any of the autopsy reports. Or even, you know, 4 years later, he could have read the textbook, the textbook that Kevin and Professor Gilbertson did on 14 of these cases, case studies in drowning forensics, which give incredible detail in each of these cases. And there's a lot in there, buried in there, about this group. Because I've been rereading it recently.
Right, and about that same time that you were doing, you know, you were leading the way on this. Christy Peel was still actively involved in the case before she retired from daily journalism, and I think became a mom. And last time I talked to her, was very happy not to be covering this case because it totally creeped her out. She was getting a lot of mail she didn't want to deal with, but I covered it on the air a lot. We kept having people on, just like many of the people you have mentioned. And I even, just in coincidentally, I reached out after having heard this, the FBI kind of rebuff the whole thing, you know, prima facie, just kind of at the beginning, just saying, nah, there's nothing to this. I contacted a guy who had been on recently on Coast to Coast. And this is at a time when I was on the show a lot more regularly. And I asked him as a favor whether he would look at this case. And his he was a profiler.
Uh-huh.
And he had written a book. And he did it reluctantly, but as a favor. And then I did a follow-up call with him. And I swear to you, Nikki, he was almost mad at me. I will always remember that feeling of, like, he was annoyed that I had brought this to him. And he said, there's nothing to this. I don't know why you're talking about this. This is, you know, people are looking, they're seeing ships in clouds. There's nothing here. And he wouldn't even go on the air to have a conversation about it. He said, I don't want anything to do with this case. This is dumb. And that was it. He wouldn't go any further.
Like I said, if they like the case that got Kevin Gannon on this, he was a missing persons detective in New York City, got assigned to this missing college student, Patrick McNeil, who was last seen leaving a bar, I think it was 90th Street or something. But they had witnesses who saw these people inching along in a car following him as he stumbled out of there and walked, and then he turned left on Second, and the car followed him. Second, supposedly he drunkenly went to pee in the river. Well, he walked all up and down there. You can't even get to the river very easily from that far. And it's like,
and that's consistent.
Cold in January. Why are you going to go all the way to the river?
You could have ducked in an alley. There was
anywhere.
Yeah, I mean... I'm a guy, there's 20 places to pee long before you go to a river, you know, if you're not worried, right? I mean,
in the winter. It's not even like it's July, you know?
Yeah, this is not, and at that hour of the night, it's not even really a very private act, you know, in a college town. There, you might even be having to wait in line in an alley. And that's where, it is just as you say, but yet, what do you think the FBI has been so reluctant to use its resources to coordinate these disparate police departments around the country into a more fulsome investigation?
Oh, because ever since 9/11, all they care about is terrorism. That is the bulk of what they do, and that's their priority. And they have to be invited into these cases. That's another reason. Law enforcement doesn't like to contradict other law enforcement. That's also what Kevin and those guys are running up against. These are smaller, whatever police department it is, none wants to admit they might have a serial killings in their midst, nor do they want to put the resources into the money and the time into finding who's doing this. It's easier to chalk them up as drownings. And if you think about it as sort of a devil's advocate, what better way to disguise a murder than a drowning? Because as I was talking to some of these drowning experts that have been involved with the case, you know, the first, whenever they find a body in a body of water, first conclusion is, oh, they drowned.
Right.
They don't preserve the scene. They don't, you know, try to do anything. They just, you know, oh, they drowned. And there's so many weird things about these drownings. I mean, the one kid was found standing straight up in the water. Okay, I don't know how that happened. Another
Exactly.
kid, Joshua Snell, remember he called his friend saying he was scared and being pursued by people he didn't know, and then
Ugh.
he was found dead. There's the survivor, you remember him, Colin Fortney, the survivor, the one who was out with his friends drinking at 1 o'clock in the morning. The next thing you know, it's 5:30 in the morning. He's swimming in the middle of the river and doesn't know how in the hell he got there and doesn't remember the last 4 hours. So he took himself to an emergency room and got treated. But yeah, he's one of the survivors of these guys.
You know, this is, we're talking with Nikki Egan. She wrote this great piece yesterday in the Daily Beast, and you can link up to it through coasttocoastam.com. Do you still write for People occasionally, by the way?
No, I left there
Okay.
a couple of years ago, and I just wrote a book that's coming out. And
yeah, we're going to talk about the Cosby book. I'll
yeah,
throw that
so
in.
That's what I've been doing mostly for the last year, but I still like the freelance stories that I really
Sure.
kind of care about. So when I had an opportunity to write about this again, I pitched it to the Daily Beast.
I have a friend, Casey Baker, who writes for People sometimes. And
oh, she's great. I love
Do you
her.
know do you know Casey? Oh,
Yes,
good.
yeah.
Okay, good.
Oh,
Tell
she's so
her
good.
I said hi if you talk to her. So this is where, and her dad too, who's a super nice guy. So this is where the smiley face story kind of lives, though, is in between, and I'm not elevating myself to your position, but kind of in between people like us and the podcast and other people who can, and the callers and everybody who continues to be interested in trying to find justice for these young men who seemingly suspected something that was going on that night. In many cases, not just one, were telling people that they felt like they were being followed or that they were erratic in their behavior that night, which none of their friends could account for why they were acting that way. And there's and this idea of vans that were appearing in towns that people saw. I mean, these are consistent characteristics in these testimonies that someplace that could collate empirical information like the FBI is unwilling to do. And so it just leaves it up to a bunch of other people to keep bringing it up, hoping that somebody will take interest and be able to work between all of these police departments. Although that doesn't seem like, well, let me ask you, what was the response you got to the article from yesterday?
Oh, someone immediately, this snotty writer at Deadspin immediately wrote an article dissing it, saying it had been debunked. Why are you writing about it?
Oh, God.
All of 24 years old and did
right.
like a 2-second Google search
right.
and concluded that's it. So, but I've gotten a lot of, from my journalist friends who know me and who are experienced like I am, you know,
right.
they know they're the ones who have covered some of these cases, they know how crazy some of these cases are, that it just doesn't add up.
Yeah.
So, you know, but it's just so easy in this day and age, with especially with some of the online places, all they want to do is cut other media organizations down.
Yeah, that is that weird thing.
Cheap shot they can.
Right. But I was even curious whether you've heard anonymously or discreetly from anybody else in law enforcement, because that may be the other way. And this kind of, we circle back a little bit to the Cosby case, where you never know what's going to create the momentum that's going to lead to a resolution. And in the case of the Cosby thing, I mean, it was a kind of an open secret in some regard what he was doing, but it really took a comedian making constant jokes about how many times America's dad was popping up in these stories online. Go ahead and look it up. And people started doing it. And next thing you know, prosecutors that had previously passed on pursuing it legally were suddenly sort of forced, shamed even into reconsidering it. And that's what I wonder whether could happen here, that with enough attention that we can bring to it by enough people who are credible, that somebody somewhere will say, okay, fine, you know, we'll do it. We may not like it, but we'll do it.
Well, I mean, I think that's why the detectives did the Oxygen show, because they want to take it to the public and let the public decide, because you know, they're not having a lot of luck with law enforcement. And it's sad, because if you look at a lot of these cases, it's not a lot of them, you know, there's cause of death, which is and then manner of death, so causes like drowning or gunshot
right.
wound or strangling, and manner is suicide, homicide, accident, undetermined. A
right.
lot of these are labeled undetermined, So, I mean, they're even saying we don't know what these are, but still no one's doing anything about it. But I think they're hoping that you get out into the court of public opinion with this show and social media, and that might make the difference. And with Cosby, what happened was, I think social media made a huge difference, too. And it, by the way, it was a different prosecutor who ended up reopening the case, and that was after his deposition became public and they saw what he had admitted to. But yeah, the full force of all these other women started coming forward. I mean, social media made that possible, because people when they get the information themselves can make draws to their own conclusions, but a lot of times the media is keeping that information from people, so they don't even know about it. And the media, when it has covered this in the last several years, has panned it. So people really haven't had an opportunity to, since that big flood of publicity in 2008, haven't really had an opportunity to learn about this. And social media wasn't even that big in 2008. I mean, I was surprised the People story was online.
Still, after all this time,
we'll put stories online.
We'll do our part here. I'm coming up on a break here, Nikki. Hang on. We'll do our part, and so I want to go over some of the new aspects of this case as you've been discovering them. Coming up next, the Smiley Face Killer update on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponett. Blue Monday is coming up, January 22nd. Right, this coming Monday is Blue Monday. That's the day that I believe social scientists have determined the majority of people who have made New Year's resolutions will no longer be following them, on average. It lasts till January 22nd. So I hope that's not your case, and whatever it was that you decided you're still doing, don't have to be dictated by that, but it is a... It is interesting to think that most people don't even make it through the first month. We're gonna see sort of a theme, though, tonight with these investigations. We'll get back to Nikki Egan in just a second, who wrote the Daily Beast article yesterday that about 100 people sent me, alerting me that there is now finally an update on the Smiley Face Killer case. And then coming up next hour, we'll be talking with John Greenwald Jr. of the Black Vault website. His new book is called Inside the Black Vault, and it will not be out until April. He's giving us a sneak peek, though, because of the popularity of the History Channel show on Project Blue Book. Inside the Black Vault chronicles John Greenwald's experiences getting Freedom of Information Act documents from the government regarding all sorts of different things. That's only one of them. And all the different ways that he has learned by trial and error to get the primary documents of these cases, and other aspects of the TV show. Dr. J. Allen Hynek will also be rolled into that conversation coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. But we'll get back to this important update on the Smiley Face Killer case. What do we know now that we didn't know back in 2012, which I think was the last time I ever updated it on Coast to Coast AM? This is Ian Punnett. Nicole Wisenseed Egan is the author of a new book coming up about the Cosby case, which doesn't drop for a little while yet, right? When's the actual release date?
April 23rd.
The book is called Chasing Cosby, The Downfall of America's Dad, but we're talking about the article that came out yesterday in the Daily Beast, and Nikki was talking about that she still follows this case since she was first introduced to it almost skeptically back in 2008, and has since then, perhaps amongst an elite group of people who have been following the story and trying to make heads or tails out of it since then. The update that you have on the Daily Beast was interesting because, as you point out, there's a really well-documented case of another close call, it would seem, from 2016. Can you tell us the story of Dakota James?
Oh, right. Sorry, you said close call. That threw me for a second. Yes.
Right.
So it was chilling when I talked to this woman. So about 5 weeks before Dakota James vanished, he has a close friend named Shelley, and she had texted him to see if he was going to come out, and he calls her. It's like 11:15 at night, and he's like, "Shelly, I'm cold. I don't know where I am. Help me, come get me, come get me." And she's like, "Oh my God, of course I'm on my way. Where are you?" And he said, "Pittsburgh." I think he said
North Side.
North Side. And then she said, So she's like, all right, on my way. But then she had, and they had enabled location services on the phone, which I didn't even know about.
Yeah.
So, because she had
We use
taken
them
me to
all
the
the time
airport.
to keep track of our kids.
Oh, there you go. I don't have kids, so I don't need to do that. So she actually sees, you know, on the opposite side of the city. And meanwhile, she's getting all these texts from him, and she sent me screenshots of the texts. And it's like, Shelly, help me, I'm cold, help me. And he was crying and sobbing, by the way, when he called her too. And so she finally finds him. He's outside. He's coming out of a Spring Hill suite. She told him to go into the hotel. And as she's pulling up, there's this dark vehicle there parked the wrong way, parked right in front of it. And he's heading right toward it. And she hollers out his name, and he sees her. And then he comes over to her. And he tells her, you know, she's like, he tells her, like, I don't, he did not remember the last 4 hours of his night. The last thing he remembered, he was at a work party with some coworkers. They went out to a bar. Last thing he remembered was about 7:15, and the rest of the night's a blank. And then he's wandering around the down streets of Pittsburgh. He didn't know where he was, what had happened. He was freezing cold, which is interesting because I've been reading a lot about GBH, and that is one of the things I think it can do. It heats you up so much, apparently. So then you don't have a coat on or something like that.
Right, the differential between the GPH, what it does to your body temperature, and the surrounding
So
air.
All of a sudden,
right.
He's like freezing cold. And so then she said she wanted to take him to the hospital. She thought, she's thinking, was he drugged? Was he, you know, did some, when he first called, she's thinking, was he in an accident? Was he beaten up? Like, he was hysterical crying. So, but he didn't want to go to the hospital, and she took him home. And the next day, he just was sort of like, oh, you know, he kind of brushed it off. And, you know, she would have too, but then he disappeared after a similar night out with coworkers 5 weeks later.
Yeah, and that's the tragedy. So then it really does feel like it's not just a crime of opportunity, but that somebody had targeted him. Or,
right,
I mean,
they,
it's an incredible coincidence that he would be taken at random, you know, or it's followed at random, but that somebody was watching for him and catching him at that kind of moment.
Yeah, either that was an attempt that night and it failed and he managed to get loose, or it was just stalking him or something. I don't know. I mean, but then he did vanish. And, you know, if you watch those security, you know, and of course the cops, oh, well, he drunk, he went to pee in the river and
right.
fell in. Because, of course, that's what you do. You walk down, down all these stairs to a dock to pee in a river when you could pee anywhere if you're drunk. But the thing is that they have surveillance video. They see him at like 11:49 p.m. walking across this plaza in downtown Pittsburgh, and he's fine. He's not staggering. He's not
walking a straight line.
And when Shelley said when she picked him up, he wasn't drunk. He didn't seem inebriated, anything. He wasn't slurring
he's
anything.
He's terrified.
Walking fine. He's like texting or doing something with his phone, just walking across, and he seems fine. And then he just walks down this alley. I guess the last shot of him they got was he kind of leaned against the wall for a second. And then the cameras at the other end of the alley had water in them, so they couldn't catch him. And then either could have gone left and then gone right over the Roberto Clemente Bridge to go home. But no, the cameras didn't capture him doing that. He just vanished.
You know, there's that other piece there, too, in your story where he told her that he had, on the initial case when he called her scared, said, come pick me up, disoriented where he was. He said that he had already spoken to a police officer and the cop had blown him off.
Yeah, that's what he said. He said, I've tried to help the cops won't help me. And, you know, I tried to ask all these questions. I did ask all these questions of the Pittsburgh cops, the DA's office, the ME's office. They were very rude, very dismissive, and you've got our answer. You can keep asking questions all you want, but you've got our answer. And I'm like, wow, if they treat a reporter like that, I can imagine how badly they treat the families.
On March 6th, 2017, 40 days after Dakota James disappeared, roughly, 9 weeks after the original call to his friend, a woman walking her dog saw his body floating in the Ohio River, 10 miles from where he was last seen downtown.
Right, another about 30 feet offshore, which isn't that far.
Ruled an accidental drowning. Again.
Yep. That's what they ruled it, even though there's no, like, if his body had traveled 10 miles down that river, and there's a steel and concrete dam there that it would have had to go, like, over underneath. There's no damage to the body whatsoever. And there's, it's the same type of thing. It didn't look like
right.
Its body wasn't decomposed enough to have been in the water for that long. And the mother also, and the kicker is, this is the horrifying kicker, but so the family never got just got an autopsy report. They had to specifically request the photographs from the autopsy. They weren't allowed to see Dakota. All the mother was forced to identify him by looking at a tattoo on his ankle. They wouldn't let her see her own son. And because Dakota's wishes were to be cremated, that's what they had done with him. But so it took a year and a half, but she finally got, and just this past August, she got the photos from the autopsy. And they took it to Cyril Wack, this famed pathologist, who concurred, looks like there's ligature marks around his neck. And then there's also, there's broken blood vessels and stuff among his fingers, the tops of some of his fingers on both hands, like he was reaching to get that ligature neck off his neck, whatever it was. And so he thinks that the death, it could have been strangulation, could have been the cause of death.
And part of this story isn't just that the kids are these young men, typically, again, the consistent characteristics are young, athletically built. They are not known for being, or at least at one point, one of the common characters, they were not known for being heavy drinkers. They were known for being kind of regular, perhaps, patrons at a bar for parties, but these weren't people who were walking around drunk all day long. And they were high performers. They were overachievers. They had a future. They were bright. They seemed to be targeted almost on the basis of that. And that's what made me think, I'm sure you've heard of the whole phenomenon, this rise of the beta thing, and the sort of the revenge of the beta males. A feeling that some people have, and it exists on the web, at least in word. I don't know whether anybody really turns it into this kind of tragic action, but that these are people that should be punished for being so popular because of the incels, the involuntary, celibate men who are sitting in basements, envious of the popularity of the genetically gifted or whatever. And so I wonder whether that could be a component in this dark beta male thing where they're taking revenge out on the popular and good looking.
Right. I think it's what I was saying earlier. The detectives thought the envy thing, you're phrasing it a different way, but these are the guys they wish they were. And they're not, so they destroy them.
But specifically the incel thing, this is a really interesting thing. It's much more formal, and the associations of incels around the country. So where some people thought originally this might be some satanic thing, or some group that was traveling around in a van and they were doing these initiations, then maybe it's just a matter of these sort of thrill killings that are going on amongst incels that are taking out their frustrations on the popular. I know I'm just spinning, but that's
I think even back then, I think they thought that there were different cells, and because they figured that it was organized and somewhat structured, but because they figured they had to have different groups in different cities, and that's why one of the criticisms has been, well, the writing's not the same with the smileys. Well, it's different cells in different cities, different people doing it, and as Doc said in my story, one group of five might go out and do something one night, and another group of five might do it another. But that's the only way they could figure, too, when they first started looking at this, is to how there could be a couple different ones in different parts of the country at the same time, because there has been that. I mean, there's been, like, I think 11 or 13 in Boston, too. And, you read, when you go through this book, and you look at the list of the ones in the Midwest, it's just...
Yeah.
These are not guys who die like this.
No.
And if you were, you'd see it in every city in the country.
Right.
You would see, oh, yeah, there was another drunk guy that just fell into the river when he went to the
right.
after he went out drinking.
Right.
I mean, you only see it where there's been like a cluster of these. It's not, and even statistically, they did a statistical analysis, and it doesn't hold up. That you would expect to see this everywhere. If this were just a phenomenon of, this is just this is what happens. Guys this age get drunk and fall in the river, pee and fall in the river. Then you would expect to see that all over the country, and you're not. You're just seeing it in clusters in these specific cities.
We're talking with Nikki Egan, the author of the Daily Beast piece yesterday. We've linked it up to our website at coasttocoastam.com. Just scroll down to tonight's guest, and you can read it there. And she has presented, again, making the case, along with Oxygen and various podcasts of continuing to bring attention to this very unusual story about young men and the reoccurrence, perhaps most often the smiley face, but there are other symbols that seem to be spray painted on exactly where the body went into the river or where the body would be later found.
Go ahead. They say where it went in, and they say it's the first visible man-made structure you can see from where the body was placed.
Right.
The way they've been, how narrowly they've been able to bring, you know.
And at one point, too, there was a geographical anomaly that was being studied, which was the main highway that they were, a cluster of these were all off of, was it I-70 that was cutting?
I-94,
that's right.
Yeah.
And that within a certain number of miles on either side of I-94, starting all the way in the Twin Cities and going east, not going west, at least at the time, but that they could track that through the upper Midwest. And it was almost like coming up to an off-ramp, you could take go a couple miles on a state highway, come back to I-94 and be gone. And that was consistent. Is that no longer being discussed in the case?
Well, what happened, the way that came about was Professor Gilbertson, the gang expert.
Right.
A student went missing at his university. And so he went online and just was Googling to get some information on him and then found out, he's like, oh my God, there's all these other missing kids, missing college students who have later been found dead. So there was a string of them. And so he assigned two of his grad students, they needed a project to look at them and see if there was a pattern, and that I-94 was part of the pattern. But and then he kind of set it aside, and then meanwhile, Kevin Gannon was working on it in 97. That was like the early 2000s, I think Doc was doing that. Then Kevin Gannon was the late 90s. He retired in 2001. 2002, they all connected in 2006, basically. Kevin and Anthony Duarte, his colleagues at the NYPD, and then the professor, because he had heard about the research. Because Kevin saw on CNN in 2002 that there were all these Midwest deaths, too. And he had two others in New York, by the way, within 14 months. There was another guy that disappeared after a night out at Grand Central. And the first guy, Patrick McNeil, his body was found 12 miles downriver in Brooklyn. And the Harbor Patrol told Kevin that, there's no way the currents would carry you there. And, again, no damage to the body. There's all these ship traffic and all this anyway. It would have been really banged up if it had been traveling there for, 2 or 3 months. Well, guess what? This other guy who disappears 10 months later from Grand Central, his body turns up right near where Patrick McNeil's was.
And it just defies coincidence. Yeah.
Three months later in New York City and was found in the water. So then Kevin saw the same thing was happening in the Midwest, but then he had cancer. He was fighting cancer for all of 2004. And then he got back on it and connected with the doctor. So then they start traveling to all the scenes, and that's when they develop more of the pattern. That's when they start looking. They saw this. Because, of course, Dr. Gilbertson is a gang expert, and so he's noticing this graffiti. It's not just graffiti. There's a smiley face, but there's all these other symbols, and there's
almost there's runes.
Smiley face is key to it, but there's 12 others that have to be present, too, for them to count it as being part of this.
I was friendly with Anne Rule before her death, and in interviewing her, she told me, I'm reminded of this during the conversation, that one of the characteristics of any victims of serial killers is that they're having an off night. And she said that it could be a lot of the victims of Ted Bundy. She said it was consistent throughout. The woman had cramps. She just had a big fight with her mom. She and her boyfriend were breaking up. There's just some little thing that makes us more susceptible, where we're disoriented a little bit from perhaps what our spidey sense might tell us about danger. And it doesn't even have to involve alcohol for us to have a lower sense of that. And I just keep thinking about those victims who were not drunk, but are lapped into that as well. Well, this is where we'll hold
it. I do think that they're drugged. I mean, that's the theory that these guys are putting GHB
in their drinks.
And that's... Because how else are they going to overpower? These are 6 foot tall, 180 pound athletes.
Right.
they're not going to go willingly with someone trying to grab them off the street. So
Well, that's w
so many of them have been seen throwing up, leaving a bar, even though they only had a couple of drinks inside.
We're going to keep a space here warm for you until you have another update, and we will have you back. And
Okay.
I'm really so grateful for you fitting us into your schedule at a last minute like this. Nikki Wisenseh, can find out more at coasttocoastam.com. Thank you so much. Keep doing God's work here. We'll figure this out one way or another. And we will go inside the Black Vault coming up next with John Greenwald on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.